So good morning, everyone. This is Mike, and he's going to be actually replacing his colleague Alex. So that's why the name is very different. And the talk will be using advanced storage features with VMware and Apache Cloud Stack. Not mistaken.
Yeah.
You may start now.
All right. Sounds good. So yeah, Alex Maccioli is. He works at Interroot, which is a customer of SolidFire, where I work. And initially, I was going to be doing this presentation jointly with him, but he had some family emergency, and he wasn't able to make his way over to Miami from Europe. So this is all me today. The idea here is that Alex and his company had asked for a bunch of these additional features within Cloud Stack since they use VMware. And they wanted to take advantage of a bunch of different quality of service features that SolidFire offers. And I already had a lot of these features implemented for Zen Server and KVM. And so the idea here with Alex was that I take those same features that I had implemented for Zen Server and KVM and extend them kind of into the VMware environment. So Alex's role was basically to kind of discuss how they plan on using these features in their public clouds. And so what I was going to do anyways was sort of just discuss it from more of a technical standpoint, not go so much into the code, but walk through either a slideshow kind of presentation of this, or as I was convinced to do last night, by that guy, to do a demo. So I'm actually going to do a demo instead of actually providing just slides and kind of talking about things. So hopefully with demos, everything works out as expected. But yeah, so I am Mike Tutkowski, and I work at SolidFire, which was acquired by NetApp about the February time frame last year. So it's been a little over a year that we've been part of NetApp. I've been working in the Cloud Stack environment for about 4.5 years now. As you'd expect, it's mainly in the storage area since I do work at a storage company. But a lot of the other work I've done in Cloud Stack, aside from specifically the storage area, is kind of going into these different hypervisors and making sure that they all play nicely with this new kind of storage that we introduced into Cloud Stack about 3 years ago. We call it managed storage, and I'll kind of show how that plays into what this whole demo is as we walk through each of the different things I'm going to demonstrate today. But so yeah, we're based out of Boulder, Colorado, just to kind of give you a quick overview just so you know where I'm coming from. What we develop is a scale-out storage area network technology. It's an all-flash array, and the main purpose of the system is to be able to guarantee quality of service to each of the volumes, so you're in the shared storage infrastructure, but you want to be able to guarantee performance to each of the volumes and make sure that when somebody is actively reading, writing from one volume on the system or 100 volumes on the system, it's not impacting the performance of your volume. So you have a very fine-grained way of saying how much performance to give to each of these volumes. And that was something that Cloud Stack was not really at all familiar with when I first started about 4 years ago. And so a lot of the work I've done over that time is making quality of service, storage quality of service, something that is accessible to Cloud Stack users from different hypervisor types. And the main ones, kind of as I mentioned, that I've focused on were Zen Server, KVM, and VMware. And so I always try to kind of keep parity with all of these different hypervisors as to the kind of support that that they have. And this particular demo sort of shows how I've brought VMware up to par with Zen Server and KVM. So whatever I'm showing here, you can do with those other hypervisors as well. Yeah, so other stuff here. The most important part from the CloudStack point of view is that I just use the SolidFire REST API from the SolidFire storage plugin to control all of the different things that I do when I create volumes, when I create accounts, our access control lists. All of that stuff is just done through the normal public SolidFire API. So there's no kind of custom private API stuff going on behind the scenes. Everything that I'm doing here can be done with third-party products using the same API. So that is that's the one and only slide that I have. I'm going to exit out of here and jump into CloudStack. This particular version is sort of the hypothetical 4.11 version of CloudStack. We're still in the process of putting out 4.10. I think we're on release candidate 2 now. We've had a couple issues that were noted during testing, so we haven't quite got 4.10 out the door yet. So this is the next release beyond that, 4.11 presumably. So just kind of keep that in mind. What I'm going to start off here is by going over to the infrastructure tab. Now I'm logged in just as a regular administrator, and I've got a pretty small cloud here, just a single zone, single pod, a couple clusters. I've got a Zen server cluster, a VMware cluster. We're going to go ahead, of course, for this presentation, focus on the VMware cluster. I've just got two hosts in each of those clusters, and right now just a single primary storage that's being used by my Zen server cluster. It's just running my system VMs just to kind of keep those off to the side so they don't make things more complicated when we're looking at things throughout the process of this demo. We can kind of ignore the system VMs. They're just running on a different cluster. So the first thing we're going to do here is add a new type of primary storage. So as you'd expect, you go into the View All button for primary storage. There's the one and only current primary storage I have. That's just NFS, and like I mentioned before, it's just running my Zen server system VMs. I'm going to go ahead and add primary storage, so go to the upper right and just fill this out the way you normally would expect, but there's actually some unique pieces to this type of primary storage that you may or may not be familiar with, so I think some of this will be new to a lot of people. The first thing is that the scope for this particular type of primary storage is going to be zone-wide. So traditionally in CloudStack, primary storage was just at the cluster scope. You can do that with the type of primary storage that I'm building here, but I just wanted to kind of demonstrate that this can be done at the zone level as well. And actually beyond that, it's not tied to a specific hypervisor type either. So usually you pick a cluster which is associated with a hypervisor type, and that primary storage can only be used from that particular cluster. In this case, not only is it zone-wide, but for the hypervisor, I'm going to pick any. Now, any might be a little bit broad here. Actually, it really is going to work for KVM, VMware, and Zen Server. And they can actually all use it simultaneously. We'll see how that works in a little bit, because it actually operates differently from how normal primary storages work. Well, maybe I can just kind of go through a little bit of that here. With normal primary storage, let's just say it's NFS, we just have our NFS share, and then we just put our VHD files in there or our VMDK files, and that's just tied to a specific hypervisor type. In this case, we're actually going, and we'll see at the bottom here, we're not actually going to create a new SolidFire iSCSI volume at this point. And we're not going to do anything like NFS where we create a share at this point. All we're doing here is telling CloudStack you can use X number of bytes from the SAN and you can use Y number of IOPS from the SAN. And then when you need to, let's say somebody's spinning up a VM, that VM obviously has a root disk, maybe it's 20 gigabytes, at that point CloudStack will look through its list of primary storages. It'll see who can support that amount of capacity, and if performance is supported, can you support that amount of performance? It will find this particular primary storage that we're just creating it'll locate the plugin that supports it and start invoking functionality on it. At that point, the plugin will go using that public SolidFire API off to the SAN and create a new volume that will support that particular root disk. And so you have a one-to-one mapping between a backend volume and a virtual disk. And that is actually very useful for KVM, because KVM has very few scalability limitations. For VMware, what we're seeing here, it's still not something that you can use for every single situation, because unfortunately, VMware, and this is why they have the whole vVols project that they've been working on for years, they have a limit to the number of data stores that can be supported in a given cluster. So for every single virtual disk, you are going to basically be putting that on its own data store. And that's going to be limited by VMware's scalability around how many data stores you can have. For Zen Server, it's a similar kind of constraint. They actually support a lot more, they don't call them data stores, but they're storage repositories for Zen Server. They actually do support a lot more storage repositories per cluster than VMware does data stores per cluster, but it still is in the hundreds, like 600-700. So you probably, with Zen Server and VMware, want to have kind of a hybrid strategy where some of your compute offerings create a backend volume and just assign it to a particular virtual disk. Maybe those are the more expensive compute offerings or disk offerings. And then other ones take a more traditional approach where virtual disks can share a single backend volume. Now, I know a lot of that is a lot of words right now, so let's just kind of go through and actually do the demo and see how this actually plays out. So we've got zone-wide primary storage, hypervisor any. I've just picked my zone. I'm going to give it a name, maybe SF-1 for SolidFire 1. The protocol that we are going to pick here is just custom, and that's going to change some of the fields below. And for the provider, you'll see here in the drop-down list, the provider is just a list of plugins that CloudStack is already familiar with. And you can go ahead and add additional plugins after the fact. You can remove plugins after the fact. This just happens to be the list that comes default with CloudStack. We've got SolidFire selected here, so that's good. Now we've got a couple options, like how many bytes from the SolidFire SAN do I want to give CloudStack permission to use? And then how many IOPS? Now, unfortunately, the way this dialog works, it's in bytes and not gigabytes. And I'm actually giving CloudStack a huge amount of capacity for my SAN usually, because you might want to make hundreds of volumes. So just to make this more convenient, I just have this in a text document. If I want to give CloudStack permission to use 2 petabytes, it's just this massive number that I copy, and then I just paste it in here. So you can make SolidFire volumes until you hit this capacity limit. You also have an IOPS constraint. This one's maybe 4.5 million. So together you have those two constraints. You can keep on spinning up. You can keep on spinning up VMs until you either hit this capacity limit or this performance limit. And that could be hundreds of volumes, or if you have really large volumes, maybe it's dozens of volumes. It just depends what you kind of put in there for those numbers. So here I've given it permission to use 2 petabytes or up to 4.5 million IOPS. Now the URL field, and if you guys have any questions about this stuff, just kind of shout it out and we can ask, answer them as we go. But the URL field, it's really, in this particular case, it's just a collection of key value pairs that have some use for the plugin. So some things might be like, actually I got this in my document as well, and I'll highlight that for you. So in the upper right, it's kind of hard to see, I guess, there. I'll just describe it. There's things like, what's the IP address that I should send management commands to? So if I want to create a volume, what's the IP address that I use for the for the SolidFire API to send those management commands to. And then on the data path, there's also a different IP address. And so if I'm setting up an ESXi host, that's the IP address that it's going to look for, it's going to use when it looks for the volume that we tell it to log into. So we've got kind of the control path covered and the data path. Those are just kind of key value pairs. And those are basically, since it's a scale out system, you could sort of picture the system as starting with like four independent storage nodes, and it's a scale out system. So as you need to grow either performance or capacity, you just purchase additional nodes, add them into the cluster. These IP addresses just float across the cluster. One of the nodes is hosting the MVIP at all times, one is hosting the SVIP. If that node goes offline, another node will just pick up on that IP address and continue to serve out those functions. So just things like that are part of this URL field. Obviously, you need some kind of a credentials when I send these commands to create volumes and accounts and stuff like that. So that's part of this as well. What's the username? What's his password? And then a few default values. So we don't probably need to go through all of those. I'm just going to copy that and stick it in the URL field. And then just like any other primary storage, we're just going to give it a storage tag. So maybe SF-A. So kind of to recap, zone-wide primary storage. It's accessible to any hypervisor type. It's managed, what's known as managed storage. Now, I didn't check the box here, but you don't technically have to in this particular case because this plugin is always considered managed storage. And if you're not familiar with that term, what managed means is that CloudStack will actually handle a lot of the operations for you. So normally when you would create primary storage in CloudStack, if it was going to be based on let's say an iSCSI volume, normally you would be responsible for going off to the storage system, creating the volume, giving it the right size, whatever. Then you would go over to VMware or Zen Server, you would create a data store or a storage repository on it, and then you would finally come to CloudStack and say, here's the data store or the storage repository, you can use this as primary storage. In this case, we're really just saying, here's a bunch of bytes, here's a bunch of performance. When you need to, go talk to the plugin, it will create the volume with the right size and performance, and then CloudStack will know if it's KVM, you're actually done at that point. I can take that volume and pass it directly into the VM. It can be used as a root disk, a data disk. If it's VMware, it's a little bit more complex. You take that SolidFire iSCSI volume, you put an iSCSI data store on it, and then you can put your VMDK file inside of that data store. And it's a similar concept for Zen Server. So the idea of managed storage is that CloudStack will actually handle the process, if it needs to, of creating a data store or a storage repository, so any kind of a clustered file system on that based on the hypervisor type, that's handled automatically by CloudStack. But in this case, like I mentioned, for this particular plugin, it's always managed storage, so you don't really have to check that box. But if it makes you feel good, you can check the box. And at this point, we're actually set. We're going to go ahead and hit the OK button and create that primary storage. It's pretty fast because we didn't actually have to really do anything in the background there. We just pretty much populated that data into the cloud database's storage pool table. We didn't actually go and create a volume on the SolidFire cluster, nothing like that. So it's a pretty fast operation in that sense. We've got our primary storage now. It's at the zone level. Let's go ahead and create a compute offering that makes use of this and see like how this actually works. So from service offerings, by default, I'm in the compute offerings area. In the upper right, I'm going to go ahead and click on Add Compute Offering. Now let's give it a name, maybe like SolidFire Compute Offering 1. And for the description, I'm going to say, you can be as specific or vague as you like. For this demo, I think I'm just going to put in the performance expectations. So maybe the minimum IOPS, and these are considered 4K IOPS on the SolidFire cluster. maybe 200 minimum 4K IOPS, and the maximum is 1,000. So that's our description when the user's actually walking through the wizard to spin up a VM. He or she would see for this particular compute offering, this is the performance to expect for the root disk. And then I'll just fill in some generic values here. One core, 200 megahertz, maybe just 128 megs of RAM, and get back to the more storage specific areas here. So this QoS type that I'm kind of circling here, this is where we actually specify those constraints that we put in the description. So if I look at it, by default, it's nothing. It's kind of just CloudStack as usual. There's no really any storage quality of service to speak of. If you drop the box down, you can see there's a couple options. One is hypervisor QoS, which is basically just rate limiting for the KVM hypervisor specifically. What we want is storage QoS, and as soon as I click on this, we'll see there's a couple extra fields that get added to this dialog. As if this dialog wasn't large enough, it'll get a little bit larger now with minimum, maximum, and another couple fields. So here I go, I'm gonna click on that. And we've got our IOPS values here. Let's fill those in first. 200 minimum, 1,000 maximum. And just to kind of point this out, similarly to how you can actually either, for a disk offering, you can either specify the size of the volume, or you can pass that option on to your end user. You can actually do that with performance as well, either for disk offerings or compute offerings. Here I've actually, as the administrator, I've filled these values in, and they match with, of course, what I wrote in the description. If I wanted to, I could actually check the custom IOPS checkbox, and now when the user would walk through the wizard, they would see that if they pick that particular compute offering, then they can fill in the minimum and the maximum IOPS. A lot of people in public clouds don't really like to expose that option, but I've seen plenty of people use that in private clouds where they have a little bit more control over their end users. But in this case, I'm just gonna be, typical situation with a public cloud, I'm gonna say this is one compute offering, and this is the performance that you can expect from the root disk of any VMs that you spin up from this. So I filled in those values. The other value that is useful to have a little bit of an understanding if you're using either Zen Server or VMware is this hypervisor snapshot reserve value. The way hypervisor snapshots work for ESX and Zen Server, typically you have maybe just a data store, you've got your VMDK file. If you take a hypervisor snapshot, that's a Delta VMDK file that resides in the same data store. So if you are gonna support that, what we need to do is make sure if you asked me to create space for a 20 gigabyte root disk and you do wanna use hypervisor snapshots, we need to make sure that the backend volume on the storage system is larger than that 20 gigabytes so that it can support those hypervisor snapshots. And that's what this field does here. So if I do something like maybe fill in the value 100. Now if I spin up a VM and its root disk is 20 gigabytes, this means the backend volume needs to be 20 gigabytes plus an additional 100% of that number, which would just be another 20 gigabytes, 40 total. So we would expect on the backend system to see 40 gigabyte solid fire volume, even though the data store at first just has a single VMDK file that's 20 gigabytes. So now for things like KVM, this hypervisor snapshot reserve value isn't used. It's just for KVM, we just create that backend volume and it gets passed directly into the VM, and it is what it is. That whole capacity can be used for either a root disk or a data disk, but you can't take hypervisor snapshots on that kind of a raw volume. So this doesn't really even apply to KVM, but for the other two hypervisor types, it does apply. So we'll just leave this here at 100%. So whatever we do spin up in a moment, we should expect the backend volume to be double the size. The rest of this,
yeah. If you reserve for hypervisor, it's going to be reserved for Snapshot, or the user can start this 20 and now becomes 40, and he has available all the 40 to use in his root, or is going to see just 20 and another 20 is going to be invisible for him for Snapshot?
So that's a really good question. So I think I'm supposed to repeat those questions because we're recording this and the recording device doesn't actually pick up on all that stuff. So the question is, if you do specify, say, 100% hypervisor snapshot reserve, we have a 20 gigabyte root disk, which means a 40 gigabyte backend volume. Can that additional 20 gigabytes be used for the, are you saying if you expand the root disk?
And
can you,
the user is going to see 40, it's just a matter of when you launch.
Oh, I see.
It's going to be 40. And he may use for
other
things. And then when he does the snapshot, really, he's already using everything. It's going to be something totally reserved, really reserved.
Okay, so what will happen is the user will actually only see the 20 gigabytes. And there'll be an administrator could actually look at the data store and see that it's 40 gigabytes in size. And so if the user starts taking hypervisor snapshots, it will eat into that second 20 gigabytes. And if you do things like resize the root disk, which you can do, let's say you resize it from 20 to 30, what we'll do is we'll actually take a look and say, okay, you want to go from 20 to 30, and your hypervisor snapshot reserve is at 100. That means I need to give you 30 plus another 100%. So we'll take that 40 gigabytes on the back end, and we'll expand it to 60, 30 of which, in this case, would be for your root disk. And 30 would be what the user would actually see. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So does that kind of answer that? Okay, cool. So, Bobby.
For example, as a user, if I create snapshots that are more than 100% of the size of the disk, like if I create snapshots worth like 100 gigs, how would that fit in the overall?
So if you actually created snapshots to the point that you exceeded the capacity on the back end, yeah, you would see snapshot failures in CloudStack, and you would need to go in and change your hypervisor snapshot reserve so that you increase that size of the backend volume,
right,
so that you have more extra, like you have extra space.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. For him, one more point over there. Basically, we are creating a data store, and ESXi, and then a storage repository on Zen server. According to the hypervisor snapshot reserve plus the actual volume size. So, for example, in this case, 40 GB of data store we are creating. And then the actual disk size would be 20 GB. If you keep on taking VM snapshots, eventually it will fail if it crosses 100%. And CloudStack management layer doesn't need to do anything. Hypervisor itself will fail because there is no space on the data store on which you are trying to take a VM snapshot, because it needs more space in data store. Eventually, volume sits inside the data store container. Data store doesn't have any more space, so it will fail at the hypervisor level.
Yep.
Okay.
Cool. So let's just go ahead and fill in a storage tag here. We can do, I'm just going to type in an S. So ever since 4.5, we've had this neat little GUI thing where it looks up the storage tags and helps you out. Actually, I had an intern do a Google Summer of Code, and this was one of the things that he worked on, so it actually is kind of nice. You don't mistype storage tags if you're looking for something. So here I just typed in an S. We see I have SF-A, which is the storage tag that is associated with the primary storage that I created a little while ago. So I'll just hit Enter, and that's basically it. The rest of this information we can just kind of ignore for the purposes of this demo, and I'll hit the OK button. And in a second, we have our compute offering. There it is. Now let's go ahead and actually spin up a VM that makes use of this particular compute offering. So as you'd expect, I just went over to the Instances tab. In the upper right, I'll click on Add Instance. I'm going to do this based on a template. And vSphere, I have just one vSphere template, so I'll just go ahead and make use of that. Hit the next button. I just have the one compute offering, and since it has a very specific storage tag, I know it will find the one and only primary storage that we created a little while ago that was labeled that way. So let's just keep that selected. Next. I don't have any disk offerings right now, but if we did, we could go ahead and select them here. Next, don't worry about affinity or any special networking or SSH stuff. Let's go ahead and give this a name and launch the VM. So at this point, CloudStack is looking at the compute offering. When it needs to create the root disk, it will look at the storage tags section. It will see that SF-A storage tag. It's going to scan through its list of primary storages. There's really just the two of them in our particular case, so it's going to be a pretty easy choice. Only one of the two supports that particular storage tag, and they're both in the proper zone, so it's real easy here. Just find my primary storage that was zone-wide. We know, based on the provider that we specified, which was SolidFire, we know which storage plugin to start invoking functionality on. So CloudStack will go ahead and ask that plugin, can you create a new volume for me? I believe this particular template is only got a 2 GB root disk. So it'll tell CloudStack, it'll tell the plugin, it needs to be 2 GB in size. Other information like the hypervisor snapshot reserve is there, so the plugin will interpret that as 4 GB. The plugin will also have information like the performance. So in this case, 200 minimum IOPS, 1,000 maximum IOPS. Once that's all done, we'll have a new volume on the SolidFire system, and then CloudStack, since this is managed storage, will know to go ahead and create a new data store on that iSCSI target, and then to copy the template from secondary storage down to that new volume. Once that copy process is complete, and actually let's take a look at that. I'm going to switch over to the SolidFire GUI, and this is, I had nothing on the system before. I'm just going to go ahead and hit the refresh button, and we can see here, okay, so this process, there's actually two volumes now. We've got the first one, which I created to house the template that was on secondary storage. Now it's copied to a data store within a SolidFire volume, and it's just sitting on the SolidFire system. We will then take that volume and do a SolidFire clone of it, and that clone will be a new SolidFire volume, which has a data store on it, because of course it's a clone of the original, and it'll have the VMDK file, which serves as the root disk for the VM that we're spinning up. Now there's a couple interesting complexities around VMware and Zen Server here. If you make a data store and you put a VMDK file in it, and then you clone it on any kind of a backend system, as you'd expect, you'd have an exact copy of that on the backend, which is great, except for the fact that VMware has a unique identifier in the data store. So if you have two data stores with the same unique identifier, VMware is going to complain about that. So one of the things I had to investigate in the process of adding this specifically to VMware, this feature, is how do you actually re-sign those unique identifiers? We had a similar problem with Zen Server because it has its own unique identifiers for every storage repository and every virtual disk within the storage repository. So this required a little bit of investigation and figuring out how to do that. You can contrast that against something like KVM, which has a very similar process of taking that template, I copy it down to a SolidFire volume, and then I clone it. But for KVM, it's just a raw volume. There's no clustered file system on it with its own unique identifiers. So it's a very, very fast process for KVM because the backend cloning is extremely fast. The slow part here is actually re-signaturing the data store. So if we take a look at my, I have a Windows VM here, and I'm running, here it is. This is my vCenter server view. And okay, everything is completed at this point, but we can see if I scroll down, and I know it's really hard to see there, there's this whole process. I'll run over here.
Resignature.
So that re-signature operation actually takes like several minutes. So the longest process here is actually on the VMware side. After you clone the SolidFire volume, you have to re-signature the data store, and that takes a few minutes. Once that's done, then everything else is pretty fast. So if we take a look at the final results in CloudStack, if I switch back over here, so we can see we've got our new virtual machine. If I click on its name and then go to view volumes, we can see root-16. I'll click on that and we can scroll down to the bottom here. It's on the proper SolidFire storage. So this root disk, which just to kind of give you another view, this is our vSphere the vSphere client, and it's showing me that I have a couple hosts in my VMware cluster. I've got my one and only virtual machine, and if I switch over to the data stores view, we can see that I have a data store here. Now, I didn't show this before, but the only data stores that existed before were these two on top, and those are just local data stores. They're for the local storage on each of my ESX hosts. So during the process of spinning up this VM, we created a SolidFire volume. We gave the two ESXi hosts permission on the SolidFire cluster to see that new volume. We created a new data store, which is what's highlighted here. And if I right-click that and go into Browse Data Store, we can see if I go to the right folder, we've obviously got a lot of VM files, but the one of interest for our purposes here is this one here I've highlighted. So that's the VMDK that serves as the root disk for our VM. Let's take a look now within CloudStack. If I go to Quick View, we can view the console. And I don't know, it may not be very easy to see, but I'm just logging in here, root password clear fdisk-l. So I think it's just a 2 gigabyte. Yeah, it's just a 2 gigabyte root disk. So now this virtual disk is on its own data store that's backed by its own SolidFire volume, and that SolidFire volume has its own guaranteed performance. So if you're running, say, some kind of mission critical application in this VM, you can be assured that no matter what else is going on in the cloud that you're running your application in, that the storage of those other VMs is not going to impact the performance of this particular VM. So you basically have the benefits almost of running on your own dedicated storage. But it's better even than that, because if a node fails within the cluster, we can still guarantee performance to these virtual disks based on some of the feature sets that are offered on the back-end system. So if we take a look, I'm going to exit out of here, go back over to the SolidFire GUI, hit the refresh just to make sure we've got everything here. Now, root-16, which I've highlighted, that was a newly created volume. It was placed in, I don't know if I can highlight it here, but it's this area here. It was placed in its own SolidFire account. So just like the CloudStack account system, SolidFire is multi-tenant in nature as well. And for every CloudStack account that interacts with the SolidFire system will automatically create its own equivalent account and place the volumes within that SolidFire account. So that's what we're seeing here, is a SolidFire account that maps to a CloudStack account. And then over here, this access groups area, an access group on the SolidFire system is kind of like a container, and it contains the IQNs of any hosts that can view the, you know, either read or write particular volumes on the SolidFire system. So right here we can see I have two SolidFire volumes, but only one of them is in an access group. So the other one can't be accessed by any hosts right now. It can't be accessed by either of our ESXi hosts. This one that is in an access group is in an access group with the two hosts in our ESXi cluster. So both of those ESXi hosts have permission to read and write to that data store, which is on that volume. And so it's up to the ESXi hosts, of course, to kind of coordinate their access to whatever's on that data store. And then more interestingly here, we can see that The size, because of our hypervisor snapshot reserve, is double the 2 gigabyte root disk, because that 100% hypervisor snapshot reserve led to us taking the 2 gigabyte root disk and making a 4 gigabyte SolidFire volume. The minimum IOPS are, as we expected based on the compute offering, 200 minimum IOPS and 1,000 maximum IOPS. So here we can see that at a minimum, just like you would expect, if you're pushing the volume hard enough, you will get 200 4K IOPS. The maximum is kind of what you'd expect. It's like rate limiting, but because of this other field next to it, this burst field, it's actually more flexible. So minimum is your guaranteed minimum. Maximum is typically rate limiting, but a lot of applications don't actually run consistently at the highest possible IOPS all the time. So while you're actually running below your maximum, the SolidFire system will accrue credits for your volume. And if you need to, let's say you're doing some kind of a transaction where you temporarily need to go above that 1,000 max IOPS, you can go above that as long as the system has the spare IOPS and you have the credits to expand. So that's what burst comes in. And burst isn't actually exposed directly in CloudStack. What we do is, and it was one of those URL fields, it was a key value pair that said, for every volume that you make, take its maximum IOPS and multiply it by this number, and that's going to be your burst IOPS. So what I did was I had a multiplier of 1.5 in there. I might even still have the thing up here. There you go, 1.5. So it knows whenever I create a volume, take whatever they gave me as minimum, 5 minutes? Okay, take the maximum and put that in as the maximum, take this multiplier by the maximum, that comes up with your burst. So we've got all that. And since we got about 5 minutes left, let me show some of the other interesting features here. We'll go into storage and take a snapshot. So normally in CloudStack, when you take a snapshot, it's really more like a backup. We take a hypervisor snapshot if it's VMware, and then we copy that read-only VMDK file, or if it might just be a delta, to secondary storage. And it, because it's on a separate system, it takes a while to copy that data, and it really is a backup. If you really want to just use snapshots, what you can do with this particular plugin is we can go to QuickView, for example, take a snapshot, and I'm going to hit the OK button here. So it's a little bit different based on the hypervisor type. In the end, it'll always be a SolidFire snapshot, which is, like a lot of storage systems, it's going to be a very fast snapshot, and it will reside on the storage system, so it's on primary storage. In this case, it really is a snapshot as opposed to a backup, so you don't have these really long intervals. Of course, you can always go and backup that snapshot to somewhere else if you want to later. And even though it resides on primary storage, instead of secondary storage, you can take that snapshot through CloudStack and create a new CloudStack volume from it. You can create an OS template from it if what you took a snapshot of was actually the contents of a root disk. So you can do all of those same operations, but the advantage here is that the snapshot actually ends up on primary storage and is really fast. Now, it seems here like it's taking a while, and that's because of VMware. There's something around locking of VMDK files that if I just take a SolidFire snapshot immediately, it will actually, if you try to restore from it, like make a new volume from it, ESX actually still has a lock on that snapshot, the VMDK file, and it won't let you do it. So what I have to do here is a little bit more complex for ESX. You say take a volume snapshot, I issue a command to VMware to say take a hypervisor snapshot. Then you have to wait like a dozen or so seconds. And it's not really very well documented for VMware how long it takes, but they release that lock. And so at that point, I can take a SolidFire snapshot and then send a command to VMware and say, delete your hypervisor snapshot. And then you're back kind of in the same situation you were, except for you now have a SolidFire snapshot with a copy of that VMDK file that can be used to create new CloudStack volumes. It can be used to create OS templates if it's got the right contents inside of it. So here we can see, if I go to the SolidFire system, now this is the old data. We see no snapshots. If I click on refresh, we have a snapshot. If I click on that, we can see that here's my one and only snapshot on the SolidFire system. If you were to go through this process with KVM, for example, it would be very fast. It would just be basically take the SolidFire snapshot. Don't worry about anything on the hypervisor side. For Zen Server, it's actually very similar as well. You don't have to worry about any kind of like weird locking. So if you take a volume snapshot, which ends up as a snapshot on the SolidFire system, it's just a SolidFire snapshot. It's done within a fraction of a second. So this is kind of a neat option to speed up your snapshot processes within CloudStack. And let's see, I know I only have a minute left, so maybe if you guys have any questions, I'll kind of skip some of the other things. Does anybody have any questions about this? Yeah?
Is it going to the dub? If you take a lot of snapshots, it's going to automatically the dub?
Yes. So what happens is, the question is about if you take snapshots, how do we account for that storage space-wise?
You duplicate all the...
Oh, yes. So around, if you take snapshots on the SolidFire system, it actually is, it's a very, not just a very fast process, but it takes up almost no space right away. And so then what happens is as you write to the original volume, it will change the contents of the snapshot to keep it consistent with where it was when you took the snapshot. So let's put it this way, everything is going to be, you're only going to have two copies of every unique 4 kilobytes on the SolidFire system. So if you write, all ones, and it could be across different volumes, different accounts, you will only have two 4K blocks that have all ones, and they will be separated on different storage nodes. So if one of them goes offline, you'll still have access to that data. And then similarly with these snapshots, if you take a snapshot of a volume, it's just like a metadata operation. So it's very fast and it's very space efficient. And then only as the original volume diverges from the contents of the snapshot will you actually start accruing additional space on the system. Is that kind of answer that? Okay. Anybody else?
Sorry to go, guys, but I think we really...
Okay. Why don't you come get me... you want to chat after?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is this not the presentation going to be shared?
Yeah, it's actually... I just part of the presentation.
And where are they going to put it?
Probably on YouTube, because they have like a live stream there. So.
I've also seen on Twitter, there's like Feathercast. If you look up Feathercast on...
Yeah, that's a little bit different. Feathercast is more like this. They get some people that are willing to... talk.
Okay.
So they create a very small and short talk about anything they want to talk about.
You know what, and I think what the difference is, like when I've done presentations in Europe, I haven't seen those posted on YouTube, but the North American ones are typically always.
Actually, the Europe one, they take quite a while because there are a few frontiers to process all of the data, because
okay.
You have like 50 minutes for every single presentation.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's why...
So it might end up there eventually.
Yes, eventually.
Yeah. Okay. 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 Cool. All right. Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
Okay.